Hello and welcome to Rapids Fire, the Accelerated Data Science Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Mahler. This week, we're kicking off a mini-series about the intersection of data science and sports with the hosts of the Every Day is Saturday college football podcast. Sam Moss, a data scientist in the connected fitness industry, and Cameron Weinert, a management strategy consultant based in Dallas, get together weekly to discuss a model that Sam has built over very many years that predicts spread bets in college football. If you've ever heard the expression, put your money where your mouth is, this is a great example of that in practice. Sam puts his own money at risk every week betting on college football based on the quality of his model. If you don't know anything about sports gambling, that's probably good, but we introduce some of the terminology to you. If you don't know anything about American football, there's still a story here that's worth telling to every data scientist. It's a story about the value of subject matter expertise built up over many years.
Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
It's a story feature engineering. It's a story about following your passion. And on Cameron's end, and for any non-data scientist that might be listening to this podcast, this is a story about how to be an intelligent consumer of data, about how to work with a data scientist to better understand the problem that you're facing. I really enjoy this conversation, and I hope you do too. I'll be back at the end. Thanks. What inspired you guys to create a podcast?
Man, Cameron, how did we start this thing 5 years ago? Do you remember?
I think it was we would sit next to each other and watch college football games and then realized that we should just record ourselves talking about college football games and maybe people would like to listen. Some people like to listen. It's actually been really interesting to see where our listeners come from. A few years ago, we threw a Facebook ad out and have now started to see people across the country continue to listen to us. But I think it was just our love of college football and our love of talking to each other. And we live in different cities now, so it's a way for us to connect every week and talk about something we both love.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the college football side of things, I mean, for background, Cameron and I went to undergrad together at Texas A&M. Texas A&M is a very football-centric university. So, you know, Saturdays in the fall are centered around football. I grew up in that environment. Cameron grew up a big college football fan as well. So there's a lot of passion behind that when it comes to actually predicting the games. So I studied economics in undergrad and fell in love with econometrics. And a lot of what I did in college, personal projects were centered around different sports and how I could predict them. And that's really kind of what kickstarted me into data science in general was, you know, when I was a little kid, my parents would give me sports encyclopedias for my birthday, and I would just sit there and memorize the stats, right? So I've always loved this kind of thing from a very young age, and it kind of just meshed really well. And as the years have gone on, the model that we've used has evolved significantly. I mean, at the beginning, it was just a few regressions, and which, you know, can be good, but trying to predict different games and trying to do more of a Vegas power ranking style to predict the games. But I did my thesis when I was getting my master's using neural nets to predict college football spread bets. So our data points are now individual games instead of just teams, right? Like in a Vegas power ranking. So it's evolved significantly, and the current iteration that we're using is performing very well. So it's exciting for me personally, because I've experienced a lot of growth in data science from spending years kind of working on this type of problem.
Cameron, I was told that you aren't doing the neural networks. So if you'd like, you can give the kind of background that Sam did. But I think what I'm most interested in is what you view as the pros and cons of pro sports and sports fandom becoming increasingly analytic.
Brief background, like Sam said, I grew up with sports. I would read the sports page and then walk into my parents' Sunday school class and talk the box scores with the dads in the room as a four-year-old. So always loved data. And then the parents were like, why do you care about the Boston Red Sox versus the Toronto Blue Jays? And that's always just grown in my love of sports. In terms of the podcast, the way that, although I don't come at it from a coding data science perspective, the way that I view data and what I do a lot in my day job is look at data and ask questions. And so what questions can we answer from data? For example, we just got finished recording and Arkansas beat Texas A&M last week. That's a big rivalry game. And a question that I have is, what is the record of teams that have won a rivalry game as an upset? How do they do the next week? Is there a correlation there between, okay, we just beat our rival, it was a big upset. Is there a high that they ride into the next week that propels them to win, or do they crash down because that they won their Super Bowl? So the way that I like to look at it is, what are the questions that we can ask? And then I turn and look at Sam and go, hey, can you tell me the answer? Cause I don't know how to find it. In terms of just to your other point around sports analytics, I think it, sports will still be there in its pure form. So people who are not interested in analytics per se can still watch the games and not have to think about it. But I think what it does is it helps people explain just how intense sports can be. So my favorite sport growing up is hockey. And I love seeing the analytics as how fast is someone skating? How long are people on the ice? Those types of analytics, because you really appreciate the athlete. You appreciate what they're doing, what they're putting their bodies through. And that's the pro. I think the con is you can get bogged down with too many. Data is everywhere. You can count strides, you can count speed, you can count number of times they stick handle the puck for hockey or number of times they're in the game for football, and you can get bogged down by the numbers. I think that's a con. But like I said earlier, people who aren't interested in that won't look for it. So the good thing about analytics and sports is you can dig as deep as you want, and you can have a threshold as when you stop.
What I think is curious is that I was watching a Broncos game the other day. NFL is the football that I follow. And the Broncos coach did what everybody that knows what an expected value is should have done for like the last, like, you know, 60 years. This, you know, the average is not a new number and you don't need a supercomputer to calculate it, but like they went for it on like 4th and 1. And the commentator was like, oh, I know that's the analytics guys telling him that, but my gut tells me that you just shouldn't go for it on like 4th and 1. You know, putting aside where what their field position was, I don't remember that precisely. I do think it's interesting when people are resentful of the way the game is played being changed based on analytics introducing a new perspective to it. And I like what you said about like excessive numbers. I mean, like, you know, I just finished a triathlon, like with all the connected devices now, you can create more numbers about your morning run than were recorded in the first 5,000 years of human history. And for most people, like, it's just not going to make like a real difference. So yeah, the thoughtful use of numbers, I think, is more important than just collecting them or using them.
Yeah. And to your point, I mean, I think that's what baseball is running through right now. They're the whole money ball aspect of the sport. People are really, you see it in viewership too. Viewership is dropping in baseball. And part of that may be to how the game is being played from an analytics perspective, like all the shifts and pitch counts. You won't see a pitcher throw more than 100 pitches ever, really. And that's because of all the analytics saying like longevity of an arm versus going back to, oh, I feel this pitcher is hot, so let's keep riding him and have him throw 150 pitches in a game.
And then he gets Tommy John surgery.
Yeah, exactly.
And you talk about baseball. I think the public, both data science professionals and even people that wouldn't think of themselves as real sports fans are aware of that story, mostly because there was a movie. And football is really the last of the major, you know, the big four American pro sports to fall to analytics, if you want to characterize it this way. And my question to you, Sam, is since you have evolved your techniques over time, for a long time, like complicated econometric regressions were the best you could do in non-experimental settings. And football is just too much of a mess for that to give you like that much more of an advantage than doing nothing, you know? And so talk to us about how your own journey in evolving your understanding of techniques has moved along with the evolution of analytics in football. And I have to say this just for my own like moral well-being. If you have a gambling problem, like, seek help. There's Gamblers Anonymous all over the place. Like, don't listen to this podcast and think we're going to give you like the one trick bookmakers hate that's going to like catapult you into riches.
Yeah, I think for the NFL, I'll speak on first. they are starting to become much more advanced in what they do. And I think a big frontier of football that might be more valuable eventually than like tabular data is, you know, real-time video analytics, things of that nature, where they can predict plays people are running, what coverages people will end up in. That's where I think that football will really gain a ton in analytics over the years. Now, college is way far behind. I think there might be like 5 or 6 major Division I colleges that have a dedicated analytics department. It's a very, very low number. And I've talked to a couple of the guys that run some of those, and a lot of them are focused on very simple problems, kind of like the early stages of the NFL was. And they are focused a lot on the sports science side, which is really great. For me, for predicting something like a spread bet, obviously tabular data is still really great for that. I have to aggregate a ton of data the way that I want it to be valuable, right? Because it's still like a model is only going to do as well as the quality of data that you have and some of the metrics that you're using. So the metrics I've created that really look at things to kind of normalize pace and kind of look at how it affects like win probability and things of that nature across even individual players. I think that is where I've seen most of the value on the college side as my techniques have evolved in the last 5 years.
For our listeners that aren't familiar with sports gambling, if you're not familiar with American football, I'm really sorry. I don't know that we have time to explain its weirdness to you in this podcast. Explain to us some of the jargon of sports gambling. So you said power rankings, you're talking about spreads. For listeners that have no exposure at all to sports gambling, I'd like either one of you to explain what those mean. And I do not have a very deep knowledge of sports gambling myself. I learned what a parlay bet was from Silver Linings Playbook. Talk to us about what all this means and what exactly you are trying to predict, or your counterparty in this transaction. Like, if you were a bookmaker, like, what are you trying to do?
Yeah, so I'll keep this in the context of college football just because it's what I know the best, but this is the nomenclature is going to stay consistent through most sports. So in college football, there's a game in the fall every Saturday, and usually on Sundays, the bookmakers, so I usually just refer to them as Vegas, just kind of this broad term of Vegas, but they'll have their own internal data scientists, statisticians that are developing power rankings. And they're using those power rankings to essentially set lines. And so what those power rankings are is, hey, we're going to take a bunch of different metrics about these teams and basically give them a single number behind them. And they're going to compare the two teams that are playing and say, okay, here's our opening line. And an opening line would be the initial line that comes out. And what a line is say that Alabama is playing Texas A&M. And Vegas thinks that Alabama will win by at least 10 points, that line would be 10 points to Alabama. And it's usually notated as, in Bama's case, if they're the favorite, as minus 10 to Bama. So we're going to give Alabama 10 points, essentially. And that kind of sets up what a spread bet is, right? Is you're picking a game, but Vegas is giving one team kind of a handicap, essentially, for how the game they think will play out. And a line will change over the course of the week before it's played. And that is determined by how people are betting on the game. So Vegas wants to get as close to 50% of the bet on both sides as possible. It reduces their risk of loss. And so they're going to change the lines from how it opened throughout the course of the week based on how people are betting. So for instance, I'm using that A&M Alabama game. Say Alabama is favored by 10 points, but a ton of people think Alabama is going to win by more than 10 points. So they're betting on Alabama to cover that spread. So they think they'll win by at least 10. Vegas will move that line up to 10.5, 11, 11.5, 12, so on and so forth, depending on the amount of money that's being pushed to that side, because they're trying to keep the distribution of the bets as even as possible, or on their side of how they think from a probability standpoint that game will play out as possible to maximize the amount of money that they're going to make off that game.
Yeah, more or less they set the line. So it's kind of like an American style roulette wheel that has zero and double zero. So if you bet on both black and red and play enough games at one point, like you will lose. And that's kind of like the tax that the bookmakers take for their troubles. And so basically, in states in the United States that have legalized gambling apps, you can look at any given game in any given sport. And if you take both sides of the bet, like a madman, like you will get like, you know, between like 93 and 97% back, depending on the share that the bookmaker is taking. But, you know, like the easy way to think about it is that they set the line so there's a 50-50 chance of one thing happening or another happening. I mean, one of the first things that surprised me about sports bets was that you weren't just betting on wins.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you're normally going to have even odds on both sides of a spread bet. There are instances, especially around that opening time. I like to bet games near the opening line because you can get a little bit more value out of them, because sometimes different books will not have even odds on both sides of a spread bet near the opening of a line. Just an interesting caveat to that. But essentially, just for, you know, example's sake, you're going to have even odds on both sides of a spread bet. And so you have to hit 52.4% as your break even and correct picks to hit that break even mark. So like you're saying, if you just bet both sides on every spread bet, you're going to lose money.
And as a thought experiment, if a team that was that every reasonable person knew that like, the Mudville Hens was going to lose their game, but everybody in Mudville put like $10,000 on the game, Vegas is also or bookmakers also have a kind of supply and demand problem where they will move the line in a way that doesn't reflect reality, because at the time that they settle the bet, they want basically to be paying the losers with the winners' money. They don't want to be in a situation where they're exposed to that much risk.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's their job, is they're trying to, you know, mitigate as much risk as possible, just like other casino games, you know, that you'll see, you know, walking through Vegas. So it's the same philosophy just applied to sports. And it's an interesting twist too. I like how you mentioned, like, when you first thought about sports betting, you didn't realize, you know, or didn't think much about, hey, I'm not just picking who I think is going to win. It's a different twist. Like I'll pick, like last week, I bet on Ohio State to cover a 48.5 point spread against Akron, which is very high and seems ludicrous. And they did, they covered that. And that's like a game that I would never watch, right? If I see someone's favored by 48.5 points, I'm like, okay, this game is not going to be good to watch, right?
You know, the too long didn't listen here is that you can do better than the data scientists as an individual in Vegas. A lot of times for the reason that we talked about earlier, where like wildly irrational people will pile money onto a game and like that's not going to reflect reality. It's just
I can't just go and pick 10 games to bet on because you would have to bet on all the games to hit the 59% that the model is hitting right now. So given that data, we actually were just talking about this, Sam and I, it's not really gambling. It kind of is, but it's a more calculated risk that you're taking because, you know, a model is showing you over weeks and weeks of data that it's going to hit 59% of the time if you place a bet on every single college football game.
Yeah. And for me, I would generally categorize myself, and I think most of my close friends would too, as a risk-averse person financially. And so I don't have like a gambling type of personality in general, which I think is good. obviously, you know, when you're entering into something like this, and this is actually the first year that I've been placing bets. You know, I moved to Colorado, not for this reason, but it's just a good aside moving here, amongst a lot of other things. But I think the reason why I started placing bets this year is because of how advanced, like, and how many hours I put into making the model more advanced, and like years of games training, validating on, and seeing how well it did on my validation data. And then now seeing how well it's doing, I guess, quote unquote, in production, it's reassuring just from the amount of work that I put in and time I've spent, especially aggregating metrics. Like I've spent almost a year kind of curating metrics, sadly, but it's done well, but I think for me, it's like, kind of like Cameron's saying is I don't view this as like, hey, I think this team is going to cover this spread, you know, go State type deal. It's like, no, like there's a scientific method behind, you know, how it's outputting. And there's even more metrics that I can look at to kind of give me more confidence or not. If I desire for a game, like if I want to pick a money line, for instance, which money line, going back to gambling nomenclature, is just picking who's going to win. But odds are different in that situation, right? But I think for me, like, it's been good because I've been able to see the success it's having and placing the bets and having success on the bets as well. But I don't have like a gambling personality per se. So I think it's like a good mix. Like if you're going to get into something like this, to not necessarily have like a really big gambling personality.
Yeah. I mean, and there's still risk there, right? Oh, go ahead, Cameron.
I was going to say, and the biggest thing is it takes emotion out. I think Vegas makes money on emotion.
Yeah.
And by taking a step back and looking at the data and saying, okay, this is what the data is telling me. I'm an A&M fan, but I'm going to pick Arkansas because the data is telling me to pick Arkansas. And that pick was a great pick last week.
Yeah.
So removing the emotion from making the decisions makes it easier to step into that risk.
Yeah.
I think that's true in a lot of different settings, whether it's investing or, you know, just making life decisions. And, you know, there's a spectrum of like what I think of as like gambling. There are professional poker players that are still going to deal with random outcomes. And, you know, football in particular, there is more, you know, general stochastic noise in the outcome than there are in other sports. And you can play poker perfectly and still lose because sometimes the unlikely thing does happen. But that is much less gambly than playing slot machines where you're like looking at an iPad and sometimes it yells at you and gives you money. So I'd like to know what your guys, you know, for lack of a better word, like working relationship is like, because at a very, very high level for people that are new to data science or getting into it, this is going to be a very classic like division of labor that you're going to come across as a data scientist where you are working for a boss or a management consultant or with a subject matter expert that has good ideas about what numbers are relevant or what factors you should look at, but may not actually be like writing the Python code themselves. And as the data scientist, you will interact with them and you may also be a subject matter expert, but there's a give and take. So I'm curious about how that's played out for y'all.
I'll let Cameron take that one to start.
I feel just honestly some guilt because Sam's the one who built the entire model. So I try to do as much as I can from a podcast perspective. So I'll go in and find the games and create the topics for us to talk about and then send them over to Sam. Sam will keep me honest on this, but a lot of the upfront work was done by Sam over the past year as he has built the model. So it's become a lot simpler. You asked Sam what the podcast looked like 4 years ago, and it was hours upon hours of him working. So we've streamlined the process a bit. Hopefully I'm not too annoying with the questions that I ask. I make comments occasionally that I say, oh, I just need to learn how to code. And then Sam makes fun of me because that's the most basic sentence ever. But for the most part, I try to take as much of the operation side off of Sam just because he's done a lot of the grunt work of the model building.
Yeah. And to Cameron's point, and again, like Cameron and I are very close friends for a long time. And I love talking college football with Cameron and I love getting to do the podcast with him. And this is already a passion of mine anyway. Like the building the model, I know is my thesis for my master's, but it was also, it's been a passion project for me over, you know, half a decade now over different iterations. And, you know, at the beginning of the podcast, like Cameron was saying, I would, you know, run these regressions each week, go and look at each team, you know, and do all this stuff. It was, you know, not a lot of it was automated, right? And now like the whole thing is automated from like ingestion to the aggregation each week to actually outputting the predictions, right? And so that's takes a lot of that time and stress of doing all that off. And so I feel like this year, you know, aside from just how well everything's going from a betting perspective, has been our best year in terms of content and in terms of, you know, the podcast in general, because the big legwork that I've put in over the last year to get everything up and running was for this reason, right? So that I didn't have to go in and do a ton every week to try to figure out, you know, games that we're going to pick and all of that. So I think our working relationship is really great. And I feel like we, especially when it comes to college football, we have really good chemistry and have for a while. And I've gotten a chance to fortunately get connected with different people in coaching circles and things of that nature. And it's always fun to hear them be like, oh, wow, like you actually know a lot about this, right? Like, I think that's just like validation of the work that Cameron and I have put in over the last 5 years.
Yeah, you know, I was inspired when you told me about what you did, and I ordered 2 books off of Amazon about the data science of football without reading the backs of them, and it turned out they're both about soccer. So for anybody looking to dive into it that way, don't do what I did and at least read a little bit about the book before you order it. Cameron, let's say you're put in a leadership position in one of the, I don't know, seemingly 50 different sports books. They're now in Colorado. Sam, like, you know, it seems like there's a different one every day that like pops up. You know, in the fine print or even higher in the fine print, would you put in a clause that the in the end user licensing agreement that would ban building your own model? Because I know you'll get bounced in Vegas if you count cards, right? Like that's not cheating. Like you won't get arrested or you haven't broken, you know, gaming law in the states where I have a passing familiarity with it for like counting cards, but the casino can ask you to cash out and ask you to not come back. And so do you think there's going to be a time? I mean, what Sam does is not trivial, right? So it's not like counting cards, but if that was your call to make, was that something that you would do as, you know, or is that advice you'd provide as like a management consultant to somebody that was like running a sports book or trying to spin one up?
I think it just is it goes back to the purest form of competition in terms of markets. So if a model is better than yours, then make your model better. That would probably be my advice as a management consultant is, okay, this model is beating you. I don't think you can shut it down because that person has the freedom in this country to go build a model. So you need to either go buy their model or build something better so that model doesn't beat you. That's my first thought on it.
I mean, being lazy, like I would be like, yeah, just put it like right up front. Like you can't build your own model. And if you see somebody winning too much, like, or betting on every game, or limit somebody to like betting on like 60% of like available games, you know, that would cut out an important degenerate gambler aspect of their customer base. Yeah. I guess they would never limit the amount of bets you could place, but.
And I've done a lot of research on this and I have like a kind of an equilibrium point of the amount that I would bet on each game before like kind of being detected, I guess, in a way already, because I know like any of these apps can just say, hey, this guy's winning too much, like lock him out of his account. That's why I'm kind of thankful that there's a new sports book popping up every 5 days in Colorado. But yeah, I don't think I'll ever get to the point where because I've done a lot of research on this, of where I will bet over that equilibrium mark and kind of be like on Vegas's radar, I guess, in a way. I'm more content of like replacing my salary and then some and, you know, doing this 3 months of the year type of deal, right? Like that's kind of where I'm at with it. I'm not trying to get banned or be detected, but I think to your question of should they do that, I can see a couple of different ways. I can see one, like you're mentioning, of just doing it and, you know, you kind of can lose part of that degenerate gambler part. But what about the people that are successful and then they get like big social followings and then they attract a ton of new users, you know, to a book, a specific book, right? Like I would kind of think of it from a marketing perspective of like, hey, maybe we can sponsor, you know, some of these people to talk about this, right? Like, and convince the average college football fan isn't looking at data, you know, or important data to join our book and play some bets, right? Like I think of it potentially it could gain more from that long term.
Yeah. And that's, you know, there was a guy that was the first person that I was aware of that was doing, I think similar to you, like old school, like econometrics on football games at first. He was like a former Air Force guy and his webpage was called Advanced Football Analytics. And he was eventually, you know, a hobbyist that got a bunch of job offers. So for a couple of seasons, the New York Times had something called Fourth Down Bot that would automatically tweet out if like the expected value of a fourth down in a given play, if the coach should go for it. And now he works at ESPN. And to Cameron's point, like if I was running a book and there was somebody that was, you know, making a lot of bets and had built their own model, I would just try to like hire them. You talked about your model being fully automated at this point. So walk the listeners through, I know that like sports data isn't cheap, but I'm assuming that when you say you have a process, there's like an API there, the model fits for the week, it updates. Tell us a little bit about the stack, like the what you're using for your neural nets, all of those details would be great.
Yeah, the data I use in its raw form is publicly available. If you wanted to go out and try to do it on your own, there's different APIs that I call from. There's different web scraping that I do. All that's been collected. I just have like a cloud SQL server that I, you know, do everything in Python and Jest, store it up there. I have a bunch of processes to aggregate and create all those features that I talked about each week as I ingest the data and update the data for the teams each week. And I'm not necessarily fitting a new model each time. I'm still using what I've used from like the last 6 years. I'll go and do that during the off season, but I get a prediction based off of the week it is and the two teams that are playing. And I have about 150-ish features for each team, for each game, range from anything from player level information, positionally, like quarterback information, running back, receivers, to how well a coach has done historically in certain situations, how well a coach is perceived over time, weather stuff, you know, team level advanced metrics. There's a lot of that goes in, and then the whole script will basically run to where after that's done, it's going to call that model and predict on those games. And then I get that output, and I do that when the line, right when the lines open, which is usually like Sunday evening. And then I try to see, you know, what the model's saying, go to that, my sports book that I use legally here in Colorado, and see which odds I can get really good value on to begin with. Because like I said, a lot of times when these books open their lines, the odds aren't necessarily even on both sides. So those are the bets I place first. And then I go and look at which games the neural net is most confident in. And that's how I've been approaching it so far. So historically, what I've seen is through the first 5 weeks of the season. So we're upcoming week five will be this weekend, which is October 2nd. The first 5 weeks of the season, the variance between for a team on their performance each week changes drastically, which makes sense because, you know, you're playing a very small amount of games and that's going to happen in general over the course of the year. But once you hit week six, that variance starts to change significantly less week over week. So, and I've seen that in the historical performance of the model and the validation data is that once I hit week six, this thing will start doing better. And then bowl season and playoffs, I think it's going to do very well. And still doing well now, but I think it'll do really well.
What is the output of your model for a given game? Because like when you said like spread bets, I was like, are you outputting like a matrix? And are you using like TensorFlow or using PyTorch? Like what kind of neural net is the backbone of your predictive modeling?
Yeah, I'm using Keras, which is built on top of TensorFlow, and it's deep learning, quote unquote. I don't know if this is a video, like, but you know, there's not many layers to this thing because there's only 10,000 games, right? Like there's not many college football games historically. Like I wish I had billions, right? Like that'd be amazing, but you know, that'll never happen. So it's not deep, but it works well for what this is. And the output is, it's a binary classification problem. Do we think the favorite is going to cover the game or not? So that is the output of the model is for each game, it's going to say, okay, we have this team and this team playing. Here's all the information we have about both teams, where it's played, you know, on down the list. And then do we think that the favorite at the line set at the time the models run, which is opening lines, is going to cover. So that's the output of the model.
So are you putting those lines as input as well?
I use the lines to determine what line the prediction happens, if that makes sense.
And when you describe your whole stack as like an ensemble, or some of those features, like we aren't talking about height over weight, or like, I mean, like, no, because I mean, like when I did like econometrics, like those are some of the features, you know, that you use in like a macroeconomic regression, like basically like ratios that like encapsulate some feature of an economy or something. But
some of what I use is, and this nomenclature will be very specific to college football. So take that for what you will, if you're listening, but a lot of like different ways that I think about the game and what has worked historically from a modeling perspective has been taking things like expected points and taking that from one play to another and using a metric called expected points added and getting that down to as granular as a player level and different positions on different teams, and seeing how different positions are doing in those metrics. And then there's others, I know like Bill Connolly has kind of popularized a metric called success rate, which is basically like how well an offense or defense does at keeping another team at bay. It's a little bit different. Like expected points added kind of measures more explosiveness, where success rates kind of measure more consistency. And then how those affect win probabilities as well. So there's like historical win probability data at the play level and seeing how different positions and different situations impact those, right? And then aggregating all of those to different levels is what has taken, you know, a long time. So as far as the features go, that's a lot of what's being used.
And in the off season, you're just doing like a normal, like hold out part of the data to like train and test.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
You know, I ask a lot of my guests about, you know, cause there's a lot of auto ML packages now that will do some like feature engineering for you. And, you know, this is a good example of something that we're at least a long ways off from the robots taking over, because it sounds like the neural net itself is not particularly fancy, and you know, you don't have as many knobs to pull on like an auto ML package would, and most of the work is in feature engineering.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where I think having a subject matter expertise in this scenario is really beneficial, right? Because over the past 5+ years that I've been looking at a lot of this data, I've kind of gotten a lot of ideas on how I wanted to aggregate different things. And then putting that into practice and seeing that work, I think has shown the validity of that in this specific problem, right? So I think that's dead on.
Cameron, to the now adult kid that was taking box scores to church to talk with dads about, what are some new metrics, not just in college football, but across, you know, sports, have you found particularly like engaging or useful? I mean, like I'm not a baseball guy, but I like the idea of how somebody performs over like a replacement level player. I think that's like a good way to think about stuff. What are some of the metrics that have enhanced your, you know, sports fandom, you know, that might not be the old like RBI kind of stuff that's been around since Babe Ruth?
From a college football perspective, I do like the havoc metric. So how intense a defense can be, what kind of havoc rating they have. That's always fun because, you know, you want the flashy offense, but having a havoc rating on defense where you're measuring sacks and turnovers and things like that, that's fun from a, like an old school football where there was way more defense. From a hockey perspective, I'm trying to just help people in Texas understand that hockey is the best sport in the world. So I actually look more to the sports science analytics for hockey. There's some really interesting advanced metrics in hockey, but for me, it's okay, how fast is that player moving at what weight? Therefore, that's the force of the hit. And there's metrics that are like the force of a hockey hit is greater than the force of a football hit, even though the players are smaller. And that's interesting to me to help explain to people, hey, hockey is a violent sport. These players play at 82 games a season instead of 16. Maybe you should pay attention to that gladiator, but that's more selfish than anything. Any other?
It would be a really
metrics?
Good hockey analytics project that I just thought of. Usually Cameron comes up with all the analytics project ideas, but now it's my turn to reverse the script. Now we're talking about hockey. So Cameron got me into hockey in college. He would explain that he grew up playing. He knows the game very, very well. So he could explain to me like the strategy, the tactics. And when we were watching, there was a really interesting, it seems like almost counterintuitive. If a team is down like a couple of goals, sometimes they'll send someone out to fight, like specifically to like rile up the team, like from an emotional standpoint. So an interesting analytics project would be, you know, seeing the effect that has on win probability, like in the next 5 minutes after the fight occurs, right? Like that could be interesting hockey to like send to a coach and be like, hey, if you're in this situation at like this time in the game, you just send the guy out to fight, right? And like to potentially change the win probability.
Yeah, you start seeing them bringing in like, you know, retired UFC guys that can ice skate. It's like, well, you know, he's always on the bench, but boy, he's got spirit.
He like crawls on the ice and puts someone in a headlock.
Having people tap out. I mean, that would increase the viewership for hockey. What do you think the last sport to have analytics really as a fabric of the way that it's done? What do you think that'll be? And my guess is like mixed martial arts.
In terms of the last frontier, I guess, of sports analytics, I think you bring up a really good point about MMA. I don't know if I've ever seen like a non-normal metric or a quote unquote advanced metric for mixed martial arts before. And I've watched several fights, right? And so I think that could be something interesting to potentially explore, you know, how we could create metrics for MMA or how we could do more advanced analysis in that sport.
Yeah. Where my head went before you said MMA was individual sports. So where you have one person who is training themselves and it's a strength or a sport of the mind. So my first thought was tennis, because at the end of the day, it's, can I hit the ball away from you or hit the ball past you? And people who are big tennis fans, I love tennis. I enjoy tennis. I hope I didn't offend you with the basic level of tennis that I just said. Or mixed martial arts, where it's really just an individual versus an individual competing against one another to beat the other person up or beat the other person to a point. There's only so many analytics you can have, I think, in regards to tennis. Like I just did a very quick search and there's nothing really out there about tennis. Like there's some pretty rudimentary websites that are trying to get into it. I think individual sports as a whole will take longer to get to analytics because there are less variables at play. I think when you bring in multiple players on the field, on the court, on the rink at a time, there's different variables that come into play that can impact the game in a way versus a 1v1. There's way less variables to analyze.
Something that's already become very popularized in sports analytics is like projecting out an individual player's career. Like I know they do that a lot in the NBA, where even if, you know, a rookie has marginal numbers, if they tested a certain way in the combine or they, you know, did X in certain situations, that they can still project out to like a high level player. I think that's very valuable in terms of like, especially if you're like a general manager trying to build a roster where you have a fixed amount of money that you can pay in salary to the team, figuring out how to build teams. And I know that's becoming very popular in soccer as well internationally, is finding more advanced metrics to figure out, hey, and this is more of like an economics type thing of like, hey, who can we sign or who can we add on to our team that's going to give us value that we might not necessarily have to break the bank for? So I think those are really interesting problems as well.
Where can people find your podcast? Is there anything else you'd like to plug? Any questions that you wish I would have asked that I didn't?
I guess I'll just start with where to find us. So we're pretty much on every major podcast service, Spotify, Apple, the works. You know, Everyday Saturday is the name of our podcast. You can find me on Twitter at CFB Neural Net, and the CFB stands for college football, if you're curious. That wasn't obvious at this point, but yeah, I post a lot about different games I'm looking at for that week, different analysis I'm doing in general. So if you're interested and want to know more, that's a good place to go as well.
Yeah, I am on Twitter, but I would point you to CFB Neural Net because I don't really tweet. I just read.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much. You know, I wish you the best of luck with your bets and your podcast, and hope to have you back.
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks again to Cameron and Sam for sharing their time and expertise with us. I have linked their podcast on both Apple and Spotify in the episode description. I've linked Sam's Twitter. I've also linked the raw data source that Sam uses to build his model if you want to take a look or play around with it yourself. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the podcast. Please write us a review. It helps other people find it and join our community. If you didn't like this episode, please at me at RapidsAI or at RealPaulMahler. If you have ideas for episodes, if you have questions, comments, we welcome your participation. I also think this is a great episode to share with friends and family who may not know what data science is. I think it's a really good introduction to the topic. So if you have people in your life that are still not 100% sure what you do, this might be a way to help them better understand. I'll be back next week, and I'll talk to you then. Thanks.